There are a lot of different ways to preserve foods and a lot of reasons to do it, whether it's just putting produce in the refrigerator to use in a couple days or canning veggies to use during a long, cold Wisconsin winter. We rely on food preservation every day. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, we're going to learn about one easy and effective way to preserve foods, and that is drying. Teresa Maroney is very active in her local food scene in the Twin Cities. She writes profiles and features for Edible Twin Cities. She's also written many regional books, field guides, and cookbooks. We had her on to talk about her book, Modern Maple, and her most recent is The Beginner's Guide to Making and Using Dried Foods. Her interest in drying foods began with her passion for camping and her desire to eat well in the wilderness. She lives in Minneapolis and joins us today from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio. Teresa, welcome back to the show.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Hi. So glad to have you with us.
Well, you were doing a pretty good
job. It's so good to have you back because we had you on to talk about Modern Maple.
Yeah.
And that was such a fun book. And I have to say, I thought of you because I tried a recipe that is, it's roasted rhubarb that has maple syrup drizzled over it. And it's a savory side dish, and it was delicious. And I actually thought of you and your wonderful maple recipes.
Oh, yeah. Rhubarb is actually a vegetable, not a fruit, and it goes really well with maple syrup. It's kind of interesting.
So how long has drying food been used as a preservation method?
Well, since well before recorded history, I don't think anybody even really knows. I'm sure it was an accidental method at first where early hunter-gatherers caught an animal, shot an animal, whatever they did, and cut it into strips, and it ended up air-drying over the fire or on racks or on rocks, and they figured out that that was a good way to preserve it and reduce its weight so that they could carry it with them. And we do know that in the Pacific Northwest and on both coasts, in fact, the original native peoples would soak fish in salt water and then dry it over smoky fires or in their teepees or whatever.
Mm.
And that was another original method of preservation, but it's been going on for a pretty long time.
So when we talk about dehydrating food, I mean, it's kind of obvious that it's drying, but what is really the principle at work that allows it to be a good preservation method?
It's basically you're eliminating any chance of bacterial spoilage or highly reducing it. Actually, eliminating isn't quite proper because it does continue to have bacterial action, which is why if you had bought a package of, say, dried apples or dehydrated your own and you left them in the cupboard for a year, when you dug them out, they might look a little browner than you remembered because there's still bacterial action happening. Although when we dehydrate, we slow it down a tremendous amount. So it kind of reduces the bacterial problems that cause spoilage and reduces its weight, makes it easier to pack, and in general, you can keep dried food, for a very long time without too much loss of quality.
And I think I'm remembering from the book that you said that most fruits and vegetables, at least, I can't remember what you said about meat, but that it goes down to about 10 to 20% of its original weight?
Generally, that's true, and it goes way down in size, too. For example, you can take like a frozen package of French green beans, dump them onto the dehydrator without any preparation, and dehydrate that. And in the frozen state, you're talking about that's probably 4 or 5 cups of green beans. And when it's dehydrated, it fits into about a pint jar.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's really neat. We have a cabin up in northern Minnesota that's a little semi-primitive, and I have a bunch of dried vegetables and fruits up there in jars. And if I need some fresh vegetables, I can just rehydrate my green beans or my beets or my carrots or parsnips, whatever I've got. And they take up no space, very little space, and they keep for a very long time. And if I've got them in glass jars, the mice can't get them, and everything's good.
So how does dehydrating or drying compare to canning or freezing for cost, for example?
Generally, it's a little bit cheaper to dehydrate because you don't have as much freezing, for sure. It's cheaper than freezing because you don't have containers that you don't use freezer bags and things like that that are sort of one-time use. The energy use for dehydrating is a little bit less than canning, especially if you have an efficient dehydrator. If you're trying to dehydrate in a home oven, it does end up costing quite a bit more because they're just not efficient for that, although that's the way a lot of people get started. They'll try to dehydrate something in their home oven first and just get a feel for what they can mm-hmm. do. And then if they decide they like it, they can get into even an entry-level dehydrator for not very much money mm-hmm. and start doing the real deal. And then it becomes a very efficient way to do it. And, of course, the cheapest, which is very difficult in the upper Midwest here, is sun drying. But we these days, we generally don't have enough reliable sunshine, and it's too humid up here to really do that.
Right. That was interesting in reading the book when you talked about sun drying. So it has to be temperatures over 90 degrees and a maximum humidity of quite a bit less than we generally have.
Yeah, that's the problem. In the summer, we're just too humid, and the food will molder before it starts to dry. In the desert southwest and on the west coast, they can sun dry with great efficiency. And in fact, most of the raisins that you can buy in the store are actually sun dried by the commercial producers, you know, sun made and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's not called sun made just because it sounds good. It's actually dried in the sun.
Truth in advertising for
yeah,
once.
Yeah, an interesting concept.
So you talked about using our home oven, especially if we're kind of, you know, checking it out and seeing if it's something that we want to get into. Does it matter as far as the quality or the effectiveness of the drying, whether it's a gas or an electric stove?
Generally, I'm finding, I've done a lot of experimenting with both and looking at models and things, and I'm finding that modern electric ovens typically go down to the lower temperatures required for dehydrating, which is 150 or below. And most gas ovens, you kind of have a hard time keeping them that low, although you can use a pilot light if you happen to have a gas oven with a pilot light. That works. But electric is probably a little bit more controllable and a little bit more efficient. I still like to prop the door open with a ball of foil to allow the moisture to escape from the oven, and then I also direct a small fan into the oven to kind of recirculate the air. The big key when you're dehydrating is you've got to get that moisture-laden air moved away from the food as quickly as possible.
And so you actually mentioned that convection ovens are great because they move, convection ovens are moving the hot air around the food.
A convection oven, I have a convection oven at home. I'm lucky to have one, and it actually has a dehydrating cycle where it runs generally around 130. It's kind of all ovens and dehydrators actually. They sort of change temperature. They go up to a higher temperature and then they turn off temporarily. You can hear your microwave do this. Mm-hmm. You do it on a lower power, turns off. And so then the temperature drops and the oven kicks back on. And so the temperature fluctuates quite a bit. You don't want the maximum to be over maybe 150. So it's kind of, it's a little bit of a trick, but convection ovens work pretty well.
We are talking with Teresa Moroney about her most recent book, The Beginner's Guide to Making and Using Dried Foods. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you dry foods? What are your favorites? Or maybe you've tried it and it didn't go quite as well as you hoped. Teresa would be happy to give you some advice. And Teresa, let's go to the phones. And Bill in De Pere is up. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Hi.
We've had a great success with dehydrating. In fact, we probably will dry 6, 7, 8 different vegetables for the winter. And the one thing that we've really come to appreciate is dried kale.
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, and we actually treat it two different ways. We'll either dry it and then grind it down to a powder because then you can use it in smoothies and things like that. But we also will take it out of the dehydrator and just crumble it and leave it into like in flakes.
Mm-hmm.
And that works very well for making lasagna and things like that because you can add in something in there that will soak up some moisture and put a lot of information in it. My question to you is that we don't do a lot of pre-blanching to stop the enzymatic process that you talked about. Haven't had any problems with it, but we tend to dry between 95 and 105 degrees. It takes a little bit longer, but it leaves it more alive, I guess, would be the statement I would make.
That's exactly right. And in fact, there are people that follow what are called the raw foods or the living foods diet, and they use a lot of dried foods, and perhaps that's something that you're playing with or flirting with or doing. And people that do that dehydrate at 118 degrees or below, because that's the point at which enzymatic activity, the food is still alive up till that point. So yes, it does take longer. You do have to be sure when you're dehydrating at low temperatures like that, that your food is quite pristine. It had preferably organic, certainly very clean, fresh, not damaged. If you've got an apple that you dropped on the floor, cut away the bruise spot, because that bruise is going to begin to decay faster than the rest of the fruit. So particularly important when you do low temperature dehydrating.
It'll go from the garden to the wash bin to the dehydrator in about 20 minutes.
Oh, that's wonderful. You're really getting the full value of the food. That's really neat. And also a food like kale doesn't really need to be blanched or anything like that, because it's so generally greens don't need to be blanched. They'll have a slightly brighter color if you did blanch them shortly before you dehydrate them, but they're just fine if you dehydrate them just as you described. Some foods require blanching or are better with blanching, because it'll lock in the color, it'll begin to stop the enzymatic activity. You do get a different kind of product when you blanch or pre-treat than when you don't, but you don't have to pre-treat.
And thanks for that, Bill. Let's go back to the phones, actually, because Natasha in Black River Falls, I think, has a similar question to ask. Hi, Natasha.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Good.
I'm a very new dehydrator. This is my first year doing it. And my question was about blanching. Why do you need to blanch before you dehydrate?
As I say, it begins to slow the enzymatic activity. It gives you a little bit of a jump start, and it will lock in the color. If you take a handful of carrots, you know, sliced carrots or something like that, try this sometime since you're just getting into it. This is a great way to learn about pretreatment. Cut up some carrots, slice them, and blanch half of them for a minute and a half, 2 minutes, and don't blanch the other half, don't do anything, and then dehydrate them in the same load. And you'll be able to see the difference. The ones that have been blanched will have a brighter color. They'll also tend to rehydrate more quickly than those that have not been blanched before drying. It's not necessary, as I said, to do it. You'll also find that over long-term storage, the ones that you blanched will retain their color better than the ones that you didn't. The ones that were not blanched will be duller in color and will brown more quickly in storage. They don't get awful or anything like that, but they do get darker. And if you sometimes you'll see unsulfited dried apricots or something at a co-op or health food store, and you'll notice how brown they are compared to the bright orange apricots that we buy or that some people buy at the grocery store. That's because they've been sulfited or pre-treated. And blanching is not a chemical method. It's strictly steam cooking briefly, but it has a similar effect on color retention. Mm.
Thanks for that call, Natasha. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Justin Williams, our on-air producer today, will be happy to take your call. You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. So you were talking about the color, you know, changing a little bit depending on the pretreatment or not. How does the taste of dried food compare to canned or frozen food?
It's generally a lot more intense. If you think about eating a raisin, and you consider that in its original life that was a grape, and you think about the taste of a grape versus a raisin, the grape has a much more intense flavor because the same amount of sugar and whatever else causes the flavor has been concentrated into a smaller package, and so you are getting more of it in a small bite. So, you know, when you eat raisins, you need a handful of them, and so you get a lot of flavor punch from that, whereas with grapes, you're eating one at a time, and it's wet, so the wetness is diluting the flavor as well. So dried foods are definitely more intense in flavor. Sweetness is concentrated. Even in vegetables, you'll notice a lot more sweetness in dried foods. The foods that you wouldn't necessarily think are that sweet become sweeter when you dry them.
And how would you compare the taste of, say, fresh produce to dried produce that you've then rehydrated to be able to use in a recipe, for instance?
That's a good question. It kind of depends on what the food is. In general, if you're going to be cooking that vegetable, such as carrots or something like that, you wouldn't really be able to tell much difference between a carrot that has been dehydrated and then rehydrated versus a carrot that was fresh. It's really pretty darn similar. Some foods don't convert quite as well. Eggplant, on the other hand, is a food that can be dehydrated, and I actually prefer it when it's rehydrated to fresh eggplant because it's a little firmer when it's rehydrated and less of that kind of, I hesitate to say slimy, but that texture that a lot of people don't like about eggplant.
Mm-hmm.
If you dehydrate it first and then rehydrate it, it tends not to have that particular texture that some people find objectionable.
Hmm.
So the flavor is pretty comparable.
And you also talk, you mentioned sulfites as something that's often added to dried fruits mm-hmm. and probably other dried foods as well when they're done commercially. And for some people, that's a health issue. So that's one of the advantages of doing the drying yourself is that you can choose whether or not to add things like that.
Absolutely. And a lot of foods, you know, for example, people are always surprised when they get dried banana chips at the store. They're surprised to learn that not only have those probably been sulfited, they've been sugared, and they've probably been fried also. So there's all kinds of things going on in that dried banana. And if you just dry a banana slice yourself, it doesn't look anything like the ones in the store because it hasn't been quite as massaged with other treatments. But if you're concerned about sulfites or salt or any of those kinds of things, you can really control what you're doing with dried foods. And if you use them to pack dried food mixes or pantry mixes, you know, like a jar of minestrone soup mix or something in the pantry, you don't have all that salt and all that hydrolyzed yeast protein. You can do gluten-free pretty easily.
Mm.
You can do, you know, specialized diet kind of stuff. Low sodium is really easy to do with dried foods. And these are all health issues for people, and the sulfite is a real big one. So
right.
A very bad reaction to that.
Let's go back to the phones and Robert in Milwaukee. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm wondering about the possible loss of nutrition, nutritive value of the foods when they're dried. For example, when you dry herbs, I heard that there's like volatile oils or things in there, and of course they would be lost. And then, you know, when you dry a raisin in the sun, you hear about sun-dried raisins. You know, the ultraviolet is actually being put upon the raisin when it's not a grape anymore. I also am wondering if drying slows the absorption of sugar from the various fruits that you eat.
Hmm. Good questions.
Yeah, that's a good question. Nutritive value, you do lose some nutritive value any time, as soon as the vegetable or the fruit or the whatever it is picked, it does begin to lose nutritive value. Whether you cook it fresh or eat it raw, as soon as it's picked, it starts to lose value. And the same thing will happen when you're dehydrating. You're losing a little bit. With herbs, Robert, you mentioned the volatile oils, and that's one of the reasons that we tend to, with dried herbs, we use a very low temperature if we use a dehydrator. And when possible, we actually just air dry them, which works really well with herbs. And that's all described in the book, too. UV, that's somewhat of a, it causes loss of nutrient and also causes some color changes in foods. And that, of course, is only in sun drying, which, as I said, in the upper Midwest, we don't get to do a whole lot of that. But yeah, you do lose a little bit of nutrient, but it's not too bad.
And also, you just mentioned the UV issue. Tell us a little bit about once we do get the foods dried, how we should best store it so that it stays as healthy as possible.
If you're in for really long-term storage, a lot of it, you should definitely keep things in the dark and in a cool area, like a cool basement or something where it doesn't get exposed to a lot of light. Darker jars in a dark cupboard, you don't want them to be exposed to light because that will hasten the browning of, say, dried apples or any kind of food like that. It'll hasten the browning. If you've dehydrated meat, I recommend short-term you can store them at room temperature, but for anything over a couple of weeks, they really should be frozen, mm-hmm. which is kind of counterproductive for drying. You know, you dry it and then you still have to freeze it, but you can still take them on camping trips and things like that in the dried form, and they'll be okay for a couple of weeks at room temperature. That's fine. And also, if you think about it, if you've got a freezer full of meat and the power goes for a couple of days, your dried foods would be okay in there. But anything that you had that was fresh frozen meat,
right.
You'd have to cook it right now.
Let's go back to the phones and Sylvia in Appleton. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. I have a question about zucchini, drying it. Should it be skinned, blanched, you know, sliced and blanched?
Zucchini can be, you know, actually, zucchini is an interesting one to dry because if you slice it, I don't peel zucchini when I dry it. No, I leave the peel on and it actually looks pretty. And if you slice it thin and dry it, it becomes what's called zucchini chips, and people use them as like almost a cracker substitute. They're not like crackers. It's like a vegetable chip, but they're really good, and they look so much better if they have the skin on. Zucchinis really don't need any treatment at all.
Hmm.
It's ready to go. They're one of the easy ones to dry.
So it can just be sliced and put in a dehydrator?
Yep, slice it and put it.
Okay.
Yeah, or you can shred them. Actually, they're better if you julienne them. If you shred zucchini, they dehydrate up so wispy that you kind of lose them. But if you cut them into small matchsticks, those dehydrate really well.
And, Teresa, you talk about using a mandolin cutter for things like that, just to make sure that they're really evenly sized.
Yeah, the mandolin really helps, or a food processor if you have a good slicing setup on your food processor, because one of the big tricks with when you're drying food, the pieces will dry evenly if they're of even size. And if you've got some that are a quarter of an inch thick and some that are an eighth of an inch thick in the same load, you're going to be in there fishing around, taking out some that are dry while the other ones have to go back in. And it's just a lot easier if you get them even. A mandolin is just perfect for making even slices and julienne and that kind of thing. So kind of a specialty tool.
But easy to find.
They
also
are. And there's some inexpensive ones. The Benriner is a sort of a Japanese mandolin type replacement that you can get for about $15 at an Asian market.
It's funny you say that because that's where I see them most frequently is in Asian markets.
They use them for preparing sushi and vegetables for salads and things like that. I mean, the Japanese are very big on beautiful preparation, and a mandolin really helps with that. But the Benriner is a sort of a, as I say, it's a less expensive substitute for a true mandolin. A true mandolin is a big metal thing, and they cost about $135, I think. So
we've talked about oven drying, just using our regular oven. We've talked about sun drying, although in our climate in the upper Midwest, that's not as good an option. And then there are manufactured dehydrators. And also, you in the book, you have instructions on how to make a homemade dehydrator as well.
I do. And the home-built dehydrator is, if you look on the internet, there's lots and lots of plans for home-built dehydrators. But most of them, all of them really, that I've seen, rely on incandescent bulbs, which, as we know, have been phased out. So that's pretty hard. So I kind of redesigned one that uses a heat service, food service heat lamp, the kind that is over like a buffet table. And I used a computer case cooling fan, which is kind of crazy, but that's something that's fairly easy to come by. And I rigged that up and built a box and rigged up tray supports, and they're not as cheap to build if you have to buy the wood and you have to buy the materials and things like that. You're not going to save that much money, but they can be bigger. They can hold more food. They have a lot more flexibility, but they are bulky. So it's not necessarily the easy, quick solution that you might hope it is. And there are some manufactured dehydrators that are at a pretty good price point. If you're looking for a less expensive dehydrator to buy, always make sure that you get one that has a fan in it, because there are really cheapo models that don't have fans, and you might as well not use them.
That's good advice. Well, let's go back to the phones, and Amy in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Amy.
Hi, good morning. Teresa, I'm wondering about how you know when your product is done. I've done some dehydrating, and it seems like it's crisp and dry, but after I put it in jars, I sometimes develop mold, and so I've gotten in the habit of freezing my stuff because I'm not really sure when it's
done. First of all, when you're checking food to see if it's properly dried, you have to take it out of the dehydrator, leave the dehydrator running, but take a couple pieces out and let them cool to room temperature, because when they're warm, they feel completely different than when they're room temperature. So you want them to be leathery. Most foods are leathery. Some are, some yield slightly to pressure. But if they're thicker pieces, like a diced apricot or something, if you cut them in half, there should be no moisture on the inside. They can be a little bit sticky, but not wet. You should be able to squeeze it, and it may yield slightly to pressure, but it should not feel mushy. And also, when you're done dehydrating and you think you're done with all your batch, put them into a quart canning jar, cover it, put it in the cupboard for a day, and watch for moisture. And if you see any moisture beads or anything like that, get it back into the dehydrator the next day, because that's the food. Some pieces have not been dehydrated as evenly as others, and when you put that in the jar for a day, it gives it a chance to equalize. And that's where, if you see the moisture, you know you've got some problems, and just put the whole batch in again for an hour or something and try it again.
You also talk about if people are doing a big batch of dehydrating, that it really makes sense to store in smaller batches so that if there is any issue of spoilage or moisture, that hopefully it's only in a small portion of it instead of the entire batch.
That's correct. And also when you have a smaller batch, you know, pint jars instead of gallon jars, for example, or something like that. Each time you open up one of those jars, you're introducing a little bit of air moisture. You're introducing the possibility of bacteria from the air. So it's better to, it's kind of like buying herbs in bulk. You can get them really cheap, but if they spoil or they lose their flavor before you use them, it's not a good buy. So dehydrated food is like that too. If it's in smaller batches, it's easier to keep it fresh and keep it pristine. Keep the bulk of it in a nice cool place or even in the freezer if you want to. There's certainly nothing wrong with that. And then use a smaller batch as your day-to-day stuff.
We only have a few minutes left, unfortunately, but I want to let people know that up on the Facebook page, we do have recipes for Scandinavian crisp breads. And that's not something I would think of doing in a dehydrator. I mean, that's a complete food that you're doing in the dehydrator.
It's a cracker. Yeah, it's that Scandinavian crisp bread, which as you noticed is kind of hard to say. they're really wonderful because they've got a bunch of different kinds of seeds in them, and they use flax seed as a binder. In fact, that's really an important binder, and they dehydrate really nicely. They're not like a fried cracker in any way. They're not exactly like a baked cracker. They're closer to a baked cracker than a fried cracker, but they're wonderful, crisp, really nice crackers. I've got recipes for half dozen crackers in the book, as well as some prepared cereals. Like you can make your own homemade version of grape nuts, which is really a hoot to do, and they're really good. Wheat flakes, all kinds of things like that.
And we also have recipes up. Some the cauliflower popcorn is actually dehydrating the cauliflower, but other recipes that use some of the dried goodies, fruit smoothie, berry cobbler, couscous with fruit and nuts, those are all up on our Facebook page. In just the last minute or so, Teresa, if someone wants to get started drying food but is still a little hesitant, what advice would you give them?
Try apples first. That's my advice, because those are, they're easy to get. They're fairly cheap. They dehydrate well. We're familiar with them. They have a lot of uses. And if you try some apples and they're similar to something that you've already had, you've had dried apples probably, and they'll be a lot like that, and you'll say, hey, wow, I can do that. Now I can try drying watermelon or drying zucchini. Something.
Wow, drying watermelon. I can't even imagine that.
Oh, it's so cool. It comes out kind of like taffy. It's really,
wow.
Yeah, it's really different. It's kind of chewy and sticky like taffy, and it has a very concentrated flavor. Kids just love it.
Wow, it sounds delicious, actually.
Yeah.
Well, Teresa Maroney, thank you so much for spending time with us. Of course, we didn't have quite as much time as we hoped, but I think we hopefully whetted people's appetites to get started on some dehydrating.
Well, I hope so. And thanks for your patience with the hookup here, Judith.
Oh, sure.
All right.
Thank you so much, Teresa. Hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Bye-bye.
That's Teresa Maroney. She is the author of The Beginner's Guide to Making and Using Dried Foods. Well, talking about all those delicious dry foods is certainly enough to whet your appetite, as I said. Unfortunately, a decrease in appetite and other challenges can make it hard for older adults to get the nutrition they need. Coming up next, we're going to find out what steps to take to get past those eating obstacles. So I hope you'll stay tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.